Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find the club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. We also welcome our radio and television audiences. I'm Bruce Erickson, managing partner of the San Francisco office of the law firm of Pillsbury Winthrop Shaw Pittman and the Commonwealth Club's quarterly chair. It is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Dr. Andrew von Eschenbach, Commissioner of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. Andrew C. von Eschenbach, MD, became the Commissioner of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration in 2006. As Commissioner, he leads the nation's premier consumer protection and health agency, an agency that regulates products accounting for more than 20% of all consumer spending. Dr. von Eschenbach is a nationally recognized urologic surgeon and oncologist and the former director of the National Cancer Institute. A native of Philadelphia, Dr. von Eschenbach earned a BS from St. Joseph's University and his medical degree from Georgetown University School of Medicine. He completed his internship at Philadelphia General Hospital and a residency at the Pennsylvania Hospital, and then became an instructor in urology at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. He also served as a lieutenant commander in the U.S. Navy Medical Corps. Dr. von Eschenbach spent much of his career at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston. He joined MD Anderson in 1976 and became chairman of the Department of Urology in 1983. He eventually rose to serve as executive vice president and chief academic officer of MD Anderson, leading a faculty of more than 1,000 cancer researchers and clinicians. He also was the founding director of the Prostate Cancer Research Program at MD Anderson. A cancer survivor himself, Dr. von Eschenbach has had an impact on the fight against cancer that extends beyond clinics and academia. He is a founding member of Sea Change and was president-elect of the American Cancer Society at the time of his appointment to the NCI. In addition, he has made significant contributions to the scientific literature, having written more than 200 articles, books, and book chapters, and having served as an editorial board member of several leading journals. Dr. von Eschenbach has received many, many awards, too numerous to name here. Suffice it to say that in 2006, Time magazine chose him as one of the 100 most influential people to shape the world. Please welcome Dr. Andrew von Eschenbach.
Thank you, Bruce, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I very much appreciate that very gracious introduction. And I must confess that when I prepare myself to the other distinguished speakers who have addressed the Commonwealth Club, I'm not only greatly honored, but I am truly humbled. However, it is also true that I've been looking forward to this opportunity because I believe that the gravity of the topic I intend to discuss tonight equals that of the many important messages that have come before this prestigious audience. At my Senate confirmation hearing almost 2 years ago, Senator Kennedy, who we all hold in our hearts and in our prayers today, said that the FDA, in his opinion, was the most important agency in healthcare. Not only do I agree with that statement, but I would add the comment, sweeping yet true, that the health and welfare of every single American depends on the FDA every single day. Let me bring that down to a more personal level for you. This morning, you woke up, brushed your teeth, showered, shampooed, applied deodorant. Many women here may have put on some makeup. Some of us cleaned and put in our contact lenses, and because we're in sunny California, you hopefully put on some sunscreen. Then you took your vitamins and perhaps your nutritional supplements. And if you have gray hair like me, you might have taken Lipitor to control your cholesterol and a baby aspirin to prevent a heart attack. And if you happened to be an FDA commissioner or a former FDA commissioner, you would have also taken medication to control your blood pressure. Then you joined the rest of your family and had your orange juice, cereal, fresh fruit, perhaps an omelet with cheese and tomatoes and fresh herbs. And after that breakfast, you fed dogs and cats, perhaps, and packed lunches for the kids to take to school. In that first few hours of your day, before you even left your home, FDA had already touched your life in dozens of ways. And for the entire day, the FDA regulates products that account for about more than 20% of what we consume. In fact, those products are the most important products when it comes to protecting and promoting your health. Next time you enter a supermarket, note that with the exception of the meat and poultry counter, nearly everything else you will put in your shopping cart is regulated by the FDA. Every trip to your doctor or hospital involves placing trust in a product regulated by FDA, from the blood pressure cuffs to the x-ray machines, and from the pills to the pacemakers. Today was a good day for you and for me. We're all here and we're healthy. The system works so well that we have taken it for granted the quality of our food and drugs and medical devices will be optimal. But on any given day, things could be a lot different. What if this morning your toothpaste was flavored with diethylene glycol or antifreeze? What if your contact lens solution was contaminated with an eye-destroying organism, or your dietary supplement was spiked with a dangerous unapproved drug? Your pet's food was poisoned with melamine. Your omelet or peanut butter in your child's school lunch was laced with a lethal bacteria. We don't have to imagine these things occurring, because we have faced and are facing all of these threats, even within our recent past. Today, we are all well aware of how vulnerable we are when it comes time to protecting our health. The FDA was created just over 100 years ago with the mission to protect the American people from products which may cause them harm. And during that time, the FDA has become the world's gold standard as a regulatory agency. In the past few decades, our mission to protect the Americans of all ages has expanded dramatically because of the massive proliferation of the products which now come under FDA's regulatory umbrella. But we've been asked by Congress to do even more, because they have added the responsibility to not only protect your health, but also to promote your health by assuring the effectiveness of medical products as well as their safety. The people of FDA have accepted this mission to protect and promote the health of every single American, not just in the first few hours of our day, but throughout the day, each and every day. In doing so, FDA holds itself to the highest possible standard, perfection. While we know that being perfect is not possible for mere mortals, it's the goal we must strive for. The men and women of FDA know that safeguarding the health and well-being of the American people is a zero defects operation. There is no margin for error, because when error occurs, people die. I'm here today because many have questioned whether FDA is capable of such a task. I'm here today because the question befitting the Commonwealth Club is not whether we can, but how we can assure that the FDA, the most important agency in healthcare, is and will always be capable of such a task. I'm here today because failure for FDA is not an option. It's not an option for you and the medication you took this morning. It's not an option for our children and the food that must keep them healthy. It's not an option for your loved one who desperately awaits that effective treatment for cancer or Alzheimer's or AIDS. The importance of assuring the success of FDA is apparent, but the more probing question is, what is the source of potential failure and what can be done to eliminate that possibility? Many now recognize for a government agency with such grave responsibility and a vast regulatory portfolio, failure can result from not having sufficient resources or authority to accomplish the tasks required. That fear becomes even more real when people learn that the FDA's annual budget of approximately a little over $2 billion is just over half of the budget of the University of California's medical centers. Without a doubt, FDA needs increased financial resources as well as expanded regulatory authorities. On this point, even the agency's staunchest critics agree. These self-evident facts are important, but I'm not here today to speak about them, but just about something far more than the support for the FDA. I'm here to speak about the need to transform the FDA, because simply doing more tomorrow of what we did yesterday is a formula for failure. Today, in every aspect of life, we recognize that the world around us is rapidly and radically changing. And so the FDA must not just be resourced adequately, it must radically and rapidly change as well in order to adapt to this new world of challenge and of opportunities. I'm here today to tell you about two of the most profound changes in the world that are affecting the FDA, namely the impact of globalization and the incredible progress that's occurring in science and technology, and to tell you about some of the changes we are making to adapt to that changing world. Today, we live in a world where borders may be boundaries, but they are not barriers. They're not barriers to disease. They're not barriers to those things that can harm us. And they should not be barriers to the products and to the processes that can protect us. Global production and a rapid international supply chain makes us all interconnected and interdependent for better and for worse. But not only do the products move rapidly and in greater volume, today the very nature of these products has changed. Americans want choice and want convenience, especially in the food we consume. You know that we are facing challenges today with some types of fresh tomatoes contaminated with a bacteria called Salmonella. Part of the challenge the agency is facing in dealing with this threat, in which we can expect to be able to continue to have fresh produce and fresh fruit 365 days a year, is the fact that depending upon the time of the year, these tomatoes and produce and other fruits can come from any part in the world and come from all over the world. So in dealing with an outbreak or an issue as we are today, we must go from the tomatoes from the sick patient in a bed to the tomatoes in the field. Even when we think about drugs and medical products, they are no longer made in any one place. Medical products are not made in the USA, but rather are assembled in the USA with components and ingredients coming from every corner of the earth. And products are far more complex today because of new technologies like nanotechnology, and drugs are more complex because they're biologics and monoclonal antibodies, and foods are now being genetically modified. All these changes create new regulatory challenges for the FDA. In today's world, we can't simply be a guardian at the gate attempting to sort or remove dangerous products from passing from production to delivery to you. Instead, we have to find our way to station ourselves at the very beginning of the production process, wherever that occurs in the world and happens to be, and then maintain oversight, accountability, and responsibility throughout the entire life cycle of the product, right up until the time that food ends up on your dinner table, or that drug is in your medicine cabinet, or that medical device is at your hospital bedside. If it sounds like I'm saying that the FDA has to find a new way to do business, you're right. We need new resources and we need new authorities to do new things. But we need to implement initiatives that will enable the agency to be global in its scale and add to its scope the scientific breakthroughs and the latest technological innovations that are available. Our vision is to modernize this 100-year-old regulatory agency so that it is capable of meeting the challenge of assuring the quality of food and medical products, whatever the source. Some things we need to do are to expand our presence overseas and enlarge our corps of inspectors to make sure that all foreign manufacturing facilities comply with our standards. We need to forge new agreements with foreign countries and trading partners to maintain the standard of safety in the products that we regulate. We need to break down technological and bureaucratic barriers to gain critical information from healthcare systems, insurers, and other government agencies so that we have real-time information to make decisions on medical product performance. The good news is that all of these initiatives that I've mentioned are underway, but they will require patience and persistence. And in addition to changing what we do, we're also changing how we do it. We're changing our culture. We're changing our culture to be not only science-based, but a science-led regulatory agency that uses modern science and technology to not only guide today's decisions, but to prepare for tomorrow's challenges. We're changing our culture to not only regulate, but to facilitate by proactively providing consultation and direction to the discoverers and developers of innovative products so that they can get it right for safety and effectiveness, and we can bring those products more rapidly into the market to save lives and improve health. We're changing our culture to enhance collaborations with our federal partners at USDA, the Department of Homeland Security, NIH, Center for Disease Control and Prevention, as well as with state agencies and the private sector, especially through our efforts like our recently established Reagan-Udall Foundation. We're changing our culture to be flexible and to be open to change, including changing our own regulatory processes to make them more transparent, more predictable, much more efficient, and rapid. We're changing our culture to now be engaged in the total life cycle of products that we regulate, incorporating a strategy of prevention, intervention, and response so that we can build quality in at the outset of production and continuously assure safety and quality even long after those products have been approved. Let me give you a recent example which illustrates FDA's new culture in action. In early January of this year, we learned about a group of patients undergoing dialysis or open heart surgery that were having severe drop in their blood pressure, and some deaths occurred. One common factor among those patients who suffered adverse events is that they all received a large, rapid injection of the blood thinner heparin. The product was recalled, and we, FDA, launched a wide-ranging investigation. Within a week, we were able to isolate that the active ingredient used in this specific brand and lot of the drug that was associated with these reactions had come from a source, a facility in China. We dispatched an inspection team to China, but this time we were able to do it rapidly because today, unlike a year ago, We have a collaborative memorandum of understanding in place with the Chinese government to do so. With our regulatory counterparts in China, we began to analyze the suspicious lots of heparin using our standard routine assays that have been in use for decades. We could not find anything abnormal. And so we went beyond FDA, and we reached out to scientists in academia who were experts in heparin chemistry and brought talent to bear that we didn't have, and we asked for their help in determining the culprit. Using very sophisticated state-of-the-art technology, we discovered that the contaminant was a substance that so closely mimicked heparin activity in its appearance that conventional testing could never detect it. But once we identified the contaminant, the FDA developed a rapid screening test, and we immediately shared it with other regulatory agencies around the world, and other countries were able to check their own drug supply and in fact determined that we had uncovered a global problem. Today, the problem is under control and American heparin supply is safe, but tragically, 81 people died in the United States from severe allergic reactions to this contaminated product before we were able to respond and intervene. And so tomorrow, we want to not only do better to detect and respond, but to actually be able to prevent these problems from ever occurring in the first place. The challenges we are facing and will continue to face are always changing. Like a flu virus that mutates into a new strain and thus can't be destroyed by last year's vaccine stockpile, or a type of bacteria that grows resistant to a supply of antibiotics that are currently available. We're facing threats that will continue to morph, evolve, and transform in order to try to evade our ability to protect and promote your health. This kind of threat can only be defeated by an agency that has an approach that's resilient, adaptable, and determined to be even better. And that will continue to be our response for the future, because so many lives depend upon these medical products being safe, and equally important is the fact that we need them to be even more effective. So many lives are at risk today because we do not have drugs or devices that are solutions for some cancers or for AIDS or for Alzheimer's and other diseases. Some people are concerned that that pipeline for bringing these new solutions to patients is drying up. They say the process of gaining approval from the FDA is too long, and that the time of more than 10 years and the expense of more than $1 billion that's required to develop a drug and get FDA approval to bring it to market is just simply too great. So today, I'm going to tell you that our medical product approval process can and will be made much better. The science and technology that's enabling discovering and developing these new life-saving products can and will be used to make the regulatory process what it should be. One improvement is to modernize our clinical trials process. This process has served us well in the past, but it is slow, laborious, fraught with failure, and most importantly, it subjects tens to hundreds of thousands of patients to experimentation before we can even get an answer. FDA's working to revise this entire process. At the front end, through our Clinical Path Initiative, we're looking to new science to give us biomarkers that can provide early signals, not just of toxicity, so that we can detect that before a drug does significant damage before it's even tested in patients, but also to be able to predict which patients might benefit from that particular intervention. And we're also revising all of our biostatistical models based or used for clinical trials to help make them even more efficient. No matter how much we improve these clinical trials, these tests can never be large enough, diverse enough, or long enough in duration to provide all the information on a product's performance and safety. We simply can't predict every possible problem from a clinical trial that might occur when millions of patients start using the product. so we're going to do even more. Some problems will emerge when patients have other diseases that we could not account for in a clinical trial, or they may be taking other medications, or they may have a variety of other underlying conditions. And so for these and several other important reasons, we will develop the capability to gather as much information on a continuing basis about the impact of a new product on all patients long after the product has been approved and released onto the market. The current system we use to determine what happens after a drug is approved is our adverse event reporting system that gathers primarily negative information about a product's impact when a patient experiences a serious side effect or a negative outcome that they report to their doctor, who then incidentally reports it to the FDA or to the manufacturer, who reports it to us. It's clear to see how and why this system is suboptimal. We have to wait until a sufficient number of people recognize and then report the ill effects that they conclude may be coming from the product or the drug that they were using. And then from there, to be able to do an analysis before we can even be sure enough to take any corrective action. To make the system better, FDA has just launched the Sentinel Initiative, with the ultimate goal of implementing a national electronic safety system that is capable of tracking and the performance of a drug or a medical product from its very beginning of its use by large populations of patients. And this system, beginning with the earliest stages of clinical research and through this continual monitoring of the product as it reaches millions of patients throughout the healthcare market, will give us the capability to actively detect the earliest signals of perhaps adverse events, but even unexpected benefit. Instead of having to wait for reports of adverse events to reach us, we will actively search and seek those events from multiple databases and be able to deal with the problems, even with the complexity that we now face. What about the regulatory process itself? How can FDA improve our own internal processes to become much more efficient, transparent, and predictable? This past year, we launched our continuous quality improvement process, beginning focusing on our own internal business processes to improve our efficiency and effectiveness, but we're also addressing steps for continuous quality improvement in our regulatory process, such as improving how we manage import alerts to be able to stop admission of suspicious products at our ports, or how we conduct advisory committees that help inform us about decisions on drugs and devices. Our goal is to be a 21st century regulatory agency that facilitates discovery, development, and delivery of life-saving and life-enhancing products to patients and the public. Some may say that the only appropriate role for the FDA is to regulate and not advocate. But when it comes to drugs and medical devices, we should not be concerned only with regulatory oversight, but also with innovation. We should not just think only of safety, but also begin to think, as it particularly relates to food, about the benefits that can come from advocating for better nutrition and healthy eating. I believe that we have the opportunity to make significant changes, because the point for us is achieving safety, and the point for us is achieving better results for more patients. We can save lives by preventing negative side effects before they can happen and customize the therapeutic approaches that we have to meet patients' needs, accommodate their own specific unique risks that are inherent in individual patients. My goal is to help speed the transformation of FDA into an agency that proactively protects and promotes the health of all Americans. To have an FDA that is more flexible and adapted to the rapid and radically changing world around us. An FDA that uses modern science and technology to assure optimal performance. And to create an FDA that is a bridge, not a barrier, to the next generation of cures and more effective therapies and the promise of personalized medicine. But obviously we can't do it alone. And I'm not reluctant to ask for the help we need to make it happen. I'm asking you today for your support and your understanding as this transformation takes place. The more you understand about what we're doing, the better off we'll be. And so I urge you to go to our website to gain a better understanding of the efforts that are underway by reviewing and commenting on the many plans we have for change, from our strategic plan to our food protection plan to our drug safety plan. Walk the path with us and let us know what you think. To take FDA beyond our borders, I'm asking the State Department for diplomatic help. Help in forging new agreements with foreign countries that require them to enforce U.S. regulatory standards for the products they export. And I think after the events of the last year, we all understand how critically important these agreements are, especially with developing countries that more and more are becoming major suppliers. I've asked Congress to support the FDA by granting nearly a dozen new authorities, including our ability to force manufacturing facilities that fail to meet our standards to bear the costs of reinspection, to require food facilities to renew their certifications every 2 years. And at the top of my list, I want Congress to grant FDA the authority to ban the import of products to the United States from any company which has delayed, limited, or denied access of our inspectors to their facility. And for Congress to give us the ability to destroy, not return, defective medical products which have been refused admission to the United States so those potentially products can't do harm to patients elsewhere in the world. In this interconnected, interdependent world we live in today, America needs to demonstrate global leadership in promoting food quality and drug safety and effectiveness and raising the standards beyond our borders, and that will be the only way to ensure protection for each and every American. And yes, I've also asked the President and Congress for more resources. Yesterday, the President submitted to Congress an amendment to his fiscal year 2009 budget to include an additional $275 million for FDA to be able to accelerate the innovations I have discussed here today, as well as to implement the many other specific proposals that we have presented, including those in our strategic plan. We're extremely grateful to President Bush and Secretary Leavitt for proposing this initiative, but it will only become a reality if and when Congress acts on it. Those who retain the right to be critical at some point have the responsibility to be constructive. By the end of this week, Congress will have held 50 FDA-related hearings over the last 18 months, at which we have discussed many needs and concerns that the FDA must confront. And one of the few points of consensus was that the agency must have additional funding, and additional funding as early as possible. These dollars will translate into additional scientists, inspectors, and regulatory experts. These dollars will help create a modern system of information technologies capable of rapid data sharing and decision making. These dollars will pay for the FDA to have greater ability to make wise decisions that you and your family depend upon each and every day. The world we live in today may be flat, and it's certainly without barriers. It is also certainly filled with awesome possibilities as well as daunting challenges. Tonight, today for me, is a great day. for those of us who are fortunate enough to be in this room, today was a good day. Tomorrow, if together we work to transform the FDA, for millions of Americans, tomorrow can be even better. Thank you for the honor of being your guest at the Commonwealth Club to tell you why and how I believe we can and must accomplish that. Thank you.
I'm Don Kennedy, Emeritus Professor of Biology at Stanford, Emeritus FDA Commissioner in the reign of Jimmy Carter. It's an honor to be here with my brother Andy Eschenbach, Von Eschenbach, who has done really a terrific job and has raised a lot of questions for me to sort and for him to answer. I'm going to do the best I can to deal with this blizzard. There are lots of different categories. I have one called "How could you?" And there's a perception that FDA has become weak in enforcement and protecting consumers. The Washington Post reported in April that FDA approved experiments with artificial blood substitutes, even though data showed risks of heart attacks. And then there is quite a lot about the tomato problem. And since I think you know what's being inquired about there, why don't you touch quickly on both the tomato problem and the general perception that FDA isn't quite as strong in regulatory oversight, right, as it once was?
Those are extremely timely and important questions. Let me frame it in this way. What I've tried to share with you tonight is the fact that FDA is not becoming weaker. The problems, the challenges are becoming greater and more complex, and so FDA must continue to become stronger in order to be able to address those issues. The complexity of the tomato issue, I think, points that out, that from the very recognition of an illness, where we identify the fact that illnesses that are occurring in diverse parts of our country all seem to be related to the same kind of bacteria, creates almost a CSI-like investigation where we have to first identify with certainty the culprit, the bacteria, then go through a process of trying to detect what the common features are with regard to what was it that those patients were exposed to that might have contained that bacteria and were exposed to just a host of things every day. So figuring out what might have been common, for example, for everyone in this room in itself is a process of intense investigation. And then once we have the product that contained that bacteria, like the tomato, then the next question is, where did that come from? Now we are dealing with an enormously complex supply chain in which things are being transported, mixed, mingled, divided, shipped, and sold in a whole variety of places. Once we've gone through the supply chain to where that supplier obtained that tomato, we begin to trace it back to the source. And it may be a farm or a field, and that farm or field could be literally anywhere depending upon the growing season. So our ability to deal with the anatomy of an outbreak and get from the recognition of an illness to the source of that problem and correct it and shut that down so we continuously prevent further harm is a challenge that requires an agency with new tools, new scientific technologies, new information technologies, new relationships with partners, new authorities to be able to gather the information that's required, and then act to apply a regulatory framework to intervene to protect your health. It's not a question of becoming weaker, it's a question of we need to be better.
Here's a question about change and how are you going to deal with it. given that over a third of FDA employees are going to retire in the next 5 years, how do you plan to develop a strategy to meet the new needs? And how will you ensure that the change that you're talking about in FDA's culture continues to make progress and that FDA leadership is no longer at the mercy of political agendas?
The importance of building the workforce at FDA, to have sufficient numbers of people with the right skills and talents, is one of the most critically important issues we're facing. One specific initiative that we've undertaken is we will be launching in the next few months our plans to rapidly implement over the next 3 to 5 years a fellowship program at FDA that will bring in 2,000 fellows at very early stages of career development across the wide range of skills and abilities that we will need in this new era. Individuals who have backgrounds in everything from regenerative medicine to genetics and molecular biology, et cetera, et cetera. Bringing those skill sets into the agency at early stages of development and then creating career paths for many of those individuals will continuously nourish the intellectual capital of the future for FDA. These are the type of people who do not live in the past, but are part of creating the future. And that will be a very important part of the intellectual vigor and the culture of FDA. We're also continuously improving our career development patterns for those who are already established in the agency and bringing in, if you will, experienced individuals into the agency. And this year, we will be hiring 700 new individuals into the agency. One can appreciate that with that influx of new people into the agency, that in itself becomes an opportunity for cultural change. The other things that are motivating and driving much of the change is the recognition of how significantly these changes are improving the ability of the people at FDA to accomplish their mission. Don can tell you, and I will, you know, certainly share with you, I guarantee you they're not there for the money. They can be at any other career, any other place, at much greater personal financial reward. They are there because they are talented, dedicated public servants who care about you. What they need and want is the opportunity and ability to serve you well.
Andy, here are some questions that sort of fall under the category of doesn't it trouble you that? There's a lot of herbal supplements on the market now that people are using which are not FDA approved. That's an old story, isn't it? Here's
yes.
Here's another one, same category. Yes. All goes back to Senator Proxmire, doesn't it? Does it bother you to see commercials for drugs urging consumers to ask their doctor to prescribe them? Finally, does the FDA have any control on statements that companies have drugs to improve memory, also drugs to improve sexual performance? Probably not the same drugs.
Well, as you well know, let me come back. We certainly have very specific rules about companies not making false claims. Yes. About what they can do, whether it's improving performance or memory. So we do take regulatory action when companies are making false claims. The questions about the dietary supplements, again, puts us back in the very important issue of emerging opportunities and emerging challenges. We all recognize that in addition to the importance of food as it relates to safety, food is one of the most significant biologic response modifiers, or things that we put in our mouth each day that can be capable of promoting our health and possibly then also damaging our health. So the FDA is taking a very significant role in looking ahead at the issues related to nutrition. And part of those things that people are looking at with regard to nutrition is, of course, the role of dietary supplements. We approach them now based on the risk of them doing you harm. I think there's great opportunity for us to expand the science of understanding the benefit that can be derived from dietary supplements, nutraceuticals, and a variety of other opportunities in nutrition.
I just want to remind our radio listeners that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speaker today is Dr. Andrew von Eschenbach, Commissioner of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. I have a couple of additional questions. Pharma companies have avoided providing valuable health information and ads alongside unmoderated online health forums due to the fear that the FDA would require them to report every adverse event that might have been reported. Do you have any response to make to that? I think there's a general concern about online. Yeah.
To notify us of any adverse event associated with the use of a product. And what we're looking at and what I've tried to describe is our ability to enhance and create more effective information technologies and information management systems so that we're better able to acquire and get the kind of data and information we need about adverse events, both from manufacturers that have them reported to them, physicians who become aware of them, but most importantly, patients who are experiencing them. And that's going to enable us to be much more effective at using that information to intervene early and prevent further harm.
One questioner points out that pharmaceutical industries spend quite a large amount on direct sales and advertising and support of medical education rather than on drug R&D. What's your view about that? Do you think the pharmaceutical industry is behaving responsibly in terms of its own allocations, or would you suggest a change?
Well, I can't speak specifically to how pharmaceutical companies create their business model. I do believe very strongly that as they go about their process of marketing, we must be certain that the information that they are providing to patients is accurate and factually based. There is an opportunity for them under the First Amendment to share that information. We expect that information to be in a form and in a manner that's appropriate. There is a benefit that comes from making people aware of disease processes that they may not have paid attention to, and that the fact that there are options and interventions that can be of benefit to those. So there is a good to be obtained, but there is clearly the need for important safeguards and guardrails to keep that process directed appropriately.
I know you have plans for dealing with the problem that the industry that we're talking about, whether it's drugs or foods, is largely a multinational industry, that you have inspection obligations overseas, that exchange rates are affecting your capacity to meet those needs. Talk a little bit about how you're trying to deal with that problem.
Well, one important step that we're immediately engaged in taking is to see FDA as responsibilities going beyond our borders if we are going to protect Americans that we're primarily responsible for. So we're going to create FDA offices and disperse FDA personnel to 5 geographic regions of the world. We'd like to begin that process with China and India and Latin America, also extend that to the Middle East and to Europe as well. The objective there is to build capacity, to have an ongoing continuous presence that will enable us to further enhance the ability of regulatory agencies in those areas so that the standards are able to be improved to the level that we believe are appropriate, to be able to expand our ability to carry out inspections and oversight, to engage third parties that we oversee and certify, to further increase our ability to know at the very beginning of production, whether it's food or the active pharmaceutical ingredients for drugs or medical devices, that quality is being built in at the very outset and not just simply depend on inspecting problems out once they come into or through our borders. And so it's a multi-tiered effort, but it is a radical change for FDA to think of itself as now being a global agency rather than just simply a domestic or national one in its responsibility and scope. But it's one that we believe very strongly is important as part of our mission to protect and promote the health of every single American.
Andy, as everyone knows, PDUFA, a relatively new, in my terms, FDA amendment, provides for user fees to be paid by the pharmaceutical industry to support the new drug approval process. One questioner asks how we address the conflict of interest that might be implied in the support of these reviews by those who are being reviewed. And second, one questioner asks why the agency is not meeting its PDUFA dates now.
The prescription drug user fees were established by Congress to give the FDA the ability to charge companies a fee for a service as it relates to our processing their application for approval of a drug or a medical device. In one sense, that alleviates a burden from the taxpayer of paying for something that's of service to a private company that is ultimately going to derive profit from that product. It's extremely important, and as FDA has operationalized that responsibility and does collect those user fees, that we have done that in a way that creates a very strong firewall between the source of that fee and what happens with regard to the regulatory process. In no way is that fee that we collect ever linked to or associated with the regulatory decision or the staff that are making those regulatory decisions. But it does provide an additional revenue stream, if you will, to be able to support the operation of the agencies. It's important as we look forward that we recognize that user fees are going to be a part of our resource base. And there are other user fees that are being proposed even in the current Congress. We do need to be vigilant about how we use them internally so that they don't distort our allocation of resources within the agency. And that's one of the challenges that we've been working with Congress as it relates to our appropriation from them. So it is an important part of our revenue stream. There are complexities associated with it in terms of how that's managed. But most importantly, I want to assure you of that firewall, because in no way, shape, or form will we ever let any source of fee determine our regulatory decision. That's determined only by our mission and our responsibility to the American people.
You're in Silicon Valley. Or almost in Silicon Valley. I think I'm in Silicon Valley and this is San Francisco. But never mind. Somebody who is from Silicon Valley wants to know what FDA's plan is to release the constraints on pharmaceutical companies to meaningfully engage with their patients on online practical support communities, patient support communities like Revolution Health or Experience Project. And second, what role does FDA see for predictive in silico modeling tools to address improving clinical trial results and minimize unexpected adverse reactions?
One of the most important investments that we want to make with any additional resources that we are able to procure from Congress and through the President's budget and other steps is to really engage in developing and promoting these new information technologies. They will be useful as it relates to modeling so that we can spare both animals and patients from unnecessary experimentation and work out our understanding of drug interactions in systems and drug-drug interactions in a way that enables us to be much more knowledgeable as we make decisions about labeling and the use of these drugs. In addition to that, we're engaging in many conversations And as a matter of fact, today I had the privilege of spending time at Google. And we've engaged with WebMD in a variety of Microsoft and SaaS and on and on and on. With those who are engaged in the development of these new tools so that we can align that development with opportunities and needs that exist with regard to FDA. We are simply an information management business that acquires data, whether it's data that has to do with a drug application or an adverse event that I was just alluding to. We acquire it, we assemble it, we analyze it, we assimilate it into a context, our rules, regulations, and we make decisions. We approve or disapprove or change a label so that you have better information and better knowledge. We need better tools to do that with, and we need to work with the developers of those tools so that we can bring the finest and best technology to bear.
The timekeeper has the Arabic numeral 9 there. Before she turns it, oh, now she just turned it to 8. Before she turns it to 7, here's something that you can respond to in 1 minute. Describe the process a drug goes through to get FDA approval. Real fast.
The application comes in. It has a host of information in it, what's happened in animals, what the structure of the drug is, et cetera, et cetera. Enormous amount of information. That is disassembled. It's sent to different experts. They go through a process of analysis. They make decisions about those individual components. That's brought back together, and we give that company an indication as to whether they can proceed or go forward. It may be at that point that they take that drug from the laboratory or from animals into clinical trials, into patients. They go through a series of clinical trials, phase 1, phase 2, phase 3. We stay engaged during that process. They come back with a final application as with all of that data so that it then can be approved to be released to market. There are a variety of things that go on in the process that help us to assure, is this safe and is this effective, and what is the relative balance between risk and benefit so that for a specific population of patients, we know that the risk will far exceed, or the benefit will far exceed the risk. And obviously that varies because, for example, a drug for hay fever will have a different kind of a complexion of review than a drug for terminal cancer.
Well, it was a noble try, and I thank
you. How did I do, former commissioner?
You did fine.
Okay.
For our radio audience, you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speaker today is Dr. Andrew von Eschenbach, the commissioner of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. Here, a couple of the questions from this live audience got categorized by me as sort of, what do you think of this, commissioner? One, many best-selling books have questioned the safety of food and our food supply, from slaughterhouses and GMOs to mercury levels in fish and so forth and so on. And the question is, does that influence what FDA does? Are you sort of publicity sensitive in that particular way?
No, I don't believe I can look at the agency and be able to say that it's being influenced by that kind of pressure. What it is being influenced by is the emerging understanding of what's involved in these processes. The food that we eat, for most part, comes out of the dirt. That's how you grow it. And we are appreciating the science that must be associated with understanding what is occurring in that process, what kind of bacteria are present, where they may come from in terms of water that's used for irrigation or wildlife that goes through the fields. And as we are learning more and understanding more, we are seeing more. I'm not so sure that the things that we're describing today haven't been occurring for decades and decades and weren't even a whole lot worse. but we didn't recognize it, and we certainly didn't understand it. Today, we're doing that much better than we ever could before, and so the problem is much more vivid to us, but it may not necessarily be much greater. But I also think we're also able to do more about it, and we need to continue to be able to do more about it, especially to prevent it from happening in the first place, rather than just simply detecting it better and remedying it better. And so I don't think that the publicity is changing us in a negative way, but it is continuously giving us greater insights and awareness and understanding of the problem.
Do you have a view, and I'm really quite anxious to have you explore this question and give us your sort of personal reaction to it. It has to do with the dramatic increase in what we all call direct-to-consumer advertising. And does it concern you? Is there anything that FDA might do, not in a regulatory sense, but in the sense of dealing with its public to cope with that problem, if you see it as a problem?
Well, we're expanding we're asking for the resources and the ability to expand our oversight of direct-to-consumer advertising. We certainly want to exercise our responsibility to protect you from false information and inappropriate information. Some of the things we don't have control over that are part of First Amendment rights that I personally have a problem with is I think some of those ads are offensive. Now, that there's probably somebody in Madison Avenue that's making a lot of money that cooking it up that way, but I personally think that that might be something the pharmaceutical industry wants to rethink, not because it's illegal, but it may not be necessarily intelligent. And the reason I say that is because we're dealing with a profession of medicine and health and healthcare in which it's extremely important that we have a bond of trust. The FDA needs a bond of trust with the public, and we're working to restore and to continue to expand our trust, and the only way we can do that is in terms of that relationship. But I think that's true also for the drug companies. So when the ads begin to look like a whole lot of other kind of ads that really are intending to sell you something rather than to help you with something, then I think they probably have done themselves a disservice, and they might want to rethink that.
Well, I see the two-minute mark has been reached, delivers an obligation to me to say that there will be just one more question, which means that I have to select from the piles that I've made something particularly interesting and wonderful. Here's one. Many Americans have concerns regarding genetically modified food and irradiated food. What is the FDA doing to label these foods with indications as to how they were treated?
The issue here, quickly, is the same that it will be for all of our products. We make our decisions based on science, and we use science to be able to determine what we believe to be safe and what we know about effectiveness. And as the science emerges and as the science gives us that information, we'll continuously update that so that we're not simply fixed in time, but we're constantly ongoing. Genetically modified animals and genetically, we've just recently had lots of discussions around cloning. Genetically modified foods can have great benefit for people and for populations. And so we want to facilitate the process by which that science can be and that development can occur, but we want to do it with very strong safeguards based also on science. So it's going to be a balance. I don't think we want to say no and not allow anything to go forward. We want to do it, but we want to do it with science as the basis of decision.
Dr. von Eschenbach, thanks so much for your responses to all those pieces of paper I have.